guardian of the universe. Simply to get the forces of evil. The powers of this man.
Hulk of the sea grave.
Complete tall buildings. Up in the sky.
Is it a bird?
Is it a plane?
A mailman by day.
Cities. Guardian by night.
Defending the citizens of New York.
For centuries, the world has been protected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. World's mightiest mortal.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of the Earth.
In the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it, Kick-Ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is what the hell I'm doing here.
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
You don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess they didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
And get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
Howard the Duck. Released August 1st, 1986, budget was $30 to $37 million, with a box office gross of $38 million, and this was directed by Willard Huck. Well, just quote Fight Club, how did we end up here? Well, the preamble for this show is going to be a little bit longer than our usual retrospectives because, to the surprise of everyone, there is not a Howard the Duck movie being released anytime soon, as far as I know. But that's not why we're reviewing this. We got to go behind the curtain, and basically underneath the stage. Of all the retrospectives we have never done, and Garrett, you can chime on this momentarily, I think the most requested ever since you and I have ever started doing this together about 10 years ago is, why have you not done Marvel movies? Well, to answer that question, we have to break it down into chunks. That is not to say we have never reviewed Marvel movies before. We've done X-Men, Garrett's done Spider-Man in the past at the old place, but we've never done an encapsulating Marvel retrospective in the vein that we're doing with Stephen King. I'm going to turn it over to Garrett, and then it'll bounce back to me, because I'm leading this entire retrospective for the next 30 years. The floor is yours.
Well, that's not to say we haven't thought about it. And the thing is, it was requested of us not just by people listening, but also by people who were putting our shows on the air. But they wanted to do just the Marvel release films. And as these guys have found out throughout the course of the last few years of running this site, that's not the way I work. I'm not going to do something just half-assed. And if I was going to do it, I was going to do it my way, which is from the beginning on. And they fretted at that. And so they got tired of waiting. And what they ended up doing was a half-assed, super long show that pretty much encapsulated all of Marvel. I think it was before the release of Endgame. And I just looked at it. I was like, okay, you guys do what you want to do. But when I do it, I want to do Marvel the right way, which is doing all of it. And by the way, I also have a little toe in the waters of Marvel because I worked on a Marvel film. And my God, we'll have stories once we get to that particular film, which is not too far away, actually. So that is the main reason why, is if I was going to do it, I was going to do it right. And by doing it right, of course, like King, is going to encapsulate, I think, around 50 or 60 films. We're going to go through Incredible Hulk. We're going to go through Howard the Duck. There are a lot of things that we are going to go through that happen before we get to the Marvel films, because people don't realize that, yeah, that was a huge successful franchise that was huge in the main of film. The fact is, they've been making Marvel films since 1986. And so that explains why we are starting with this complete jumbled mess of a film, is because if I was going to do Marvel, I was going to do it right, and I was going to start from the beginning.
Has to start here, because this is technically the first theatrical film released of a Marvel property that was released in theaters. Because we're not going to be reviewing the Captain America serial that came out in 1944, the Batman serials of the late 30s and 40s, because those are not theatrical length. So let's talk about how this is all going to play out for both this part of the retrospective, because this will be broken up into chunks like we've done with a lot of the larger franchises. I think only King would rival this as far as length. Because Howard the Duck, for reasons we'll talk about, didn't spawn a franchise or really tie into anything else, I kind of wanted to start by getting the miscellaneous grab bag stuff out of the way. This part one is going to include Marvel properties as well as things that were published under the Marvel umbrella that could have been under a sub-publication like Image or Icon. So Howard the Duck is first. We're going to do Dr. Mordred, which I'm sure very few people even know what the hell that is, because it's, well, we'll talk about that. We're going to do Man-Thing. Which, yes, they made a Man-Thing movie, everybody. It was a sci-fi TV movie, and the only reason I included it is because we did the sci-fi Children of the Corn movie, and if we're going for completionism, we've got to do everything that's classified as a movie. So those are Marvel proper, and then we're doing Kick-Ass 1 and Kick-Ass 2, because those were released under Icon and Image, or Imprint, one of those two. They're technically Marvel publications, so they're Marvel movies, technically, as is Big Hero 6, and there was one I forgot about that I've included. Because if we're going to do Kick-Ass, by that same logic, we have to do Kingsman.
Oh, I didn't hear about this. Is that a Marvel property?
It's under the same publication as Kick-Ass.
Oh, wow.
And it's the same director.
No idea about
that.
Same
director.
Yeah, and not to mention, like, that's just this part.
Yeah.
And we're also going to do, like I mentioned, Fantastic Four. We're going to do the Punisher films, which Matt and I have one in that one that we've been wanting to talk about for years. It's going to be fun. And we're also going to do Blade, which Adam and I have affinity for, because we saw the first one in theaters together. And so that's what's going to encapsulate all of Marvel. And, of course, Incredible Hulk we're going to do. We're going to do a few of the Bixby TV films, as well as the Ang Lee version of that particular film. And that's going to be all before we get to Marvel proper. So this is a huge undertaking. It's something that I've been wanting to do for years and years and years. And I'm excited to finally dive into it, even when I'm not excited about the films we're having to review.
And for the record, so that part one basically, Howard the Duck through Kingsman, that's going to be part one. I called it the Miscellaneous Rejects because I couldn't think of a better title. And then to close out the year, bleeding into next year, just based on how our schedule aligns, will be The Punisher, because that is technically the next one. That the Dolph Lundgren one was 89.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do the three Punisher movies, and then we'll do Fantastic Four, because the Roger Corman movie was 94. And I would rather, even though it came out afterwards, I think it's better to do Fantastic Four earlier than Captain America, because Captain America ties more into the MCU than Fantastic Four does. Because while I should be reviewing the MCU Fantastic Four, will be the first Fantastic Four movie we review. It's just funny how this is going to work out. And then obviously we're pretty positive we're going to redo X-Men.
Yes.
Because we have to do Generation X, which we did not do for the old place, and we have Deadpool and Wolverine to include. So, needless to say, there's a lot to get through before we actually discuss the Marvel Cinematic Universe Iron Man on. Alright, so that's the discussion about how this is all going to play out. And obviously we're going to do the Raimi Spider-Man, we're going to do Blade, as you mentioned, so everything is going to get covered. Well, let's get to the guy who actually has read more comics than any of us. Adam, I got to ask you a question, because everyone has their side. As a youth, mm-hmm. and now as a middle-aged man, are you more in the Marvel camp, or are you more of a DC guy? Like, what is your relationship with Marvel as a comic book entity, not necessarily as a movie property?
Growing up, it was Marvel for me. without a doubt. And a lot of that had to do with what I was watching on Saturday morning TV. One of my first comics I ever remember buying is that X-Men number one. Still the best-selling comic of all time for good reason. Jim Lee, Chris Claremont, before Jim Lee got Chris Claremont to quit 4 issues in. So I was a Marvel guy. I was Marvel and Dark Horse, if anything else. Dark Horse was doing the Alien and Predator comics, which I absolutely adored. And other than that, I was an X-Men kid. I didn't really care too much about some of the other characters. Well, nobody cared about the Avengers that we're going to talk about down the road. That's why those were sold off. But I was an X-Men fan, huge, and a lot of the spinoffs from those. And because of that, I bought Marvel Comics. DC, on occasion. But it wasn't until I was much older that I was really getting into some of those. And now in my older life, that's kind of switched. I'll take DC over Marvel, and I'm still reading Dark Horse, Image, and other indies more than anything else. But growing up, yeah, I was a Marvel kid. I was a Marvel misfit, without a doubt.
All right, well, speaking of misfits, you know, Garrett is the only person on this podcast who likes Superman as a comic book character. So that leads into my question. You're on the record as being a big Superman guy. Did you cross the border into Marvel at all as a kid when it came to reading comics?
Absolutely. In fact, I was pretty big into X-Men, and The Incredible Hulk was a big one for me, too. Once we get to that series, I can't wait to dive in, because that was a huge character for me as well. As far as DC and Marvel, I mean, it really, when you're a kid and they didn't have the huge rival on screen like they've had in the last decade or so, it was all about not whether it was DC or Marvel or whether it was a comic book. Because back when Adam and I were going to school and discussing these, it wasn't cool to like comics. You were looked at as a misfit. You were looked at as a nerd if you liked comics way back when. Oh, Spider-Man. Big thing of mine growing up. I had a bunch of those book and records. In fact, over the holidays, when I got home from work one day, I just went on YouTube and found a couple of the Spider-Man book and records that I used to listen to as a kid. Spider-Man was a big one growing up because Spider-Man was a smartass, and I loved being a smartass. Those were the big ones that I had growing up. Comic books played a huge part in how I just fell in love with creativity and fell in love with the art of visual storytelling.
All right, this is where the age gap comes into play, everybody, because I grew up at a time where comic books were not in vogue in the 90s in particular. In fact, a lot of the diehard Spider-Man fans, as an example, will tell you the 90s was not a great decade for that character, and he was kind of the flagship of the whole Marvel banner, because remember when I was growing up, characters like Iron Man and Thor and the heroes that are A-list names now were not, when I was growing up, it was basically X-Men, Spider-Man, there's like anything that got a TV show that was animated in the 90s. And I think almost all of them did to some degree. Because even Spider-Man brought in guest characters like Blade, Daredevil, etc. So my comic reading was almost exclusively tied to X-Men. Because I think of any singular property, that's probably had the best run or series of runs across different writers and rebrandings. I mean, hell, the Ultimate X-Men kind of revived the whole Ultimate brand along with Spider-Man. So I've always been more on the Marvel side, although I like Batman more as a character than anything in Marvel. But as a comic book fan, I like the X-Men the most. That's my into comics. If you'll notice through all of this, we have not mentioned the title character of this movie. And that's kind of for good reason, because I mentioned Thor and Captain America being B-list. Howard the Duck, for being the first theatrical movie, you wouldn't think that's the first character they'd start with.
It's crazy. And I gotta go to our third on this. I need to know from Adam. Adam, what is it about this character that would make somebody who really formed my childhood say, you know what, that would make a good movie? Did you read any of these growing up? Were you aware of Howard the Duck before we got this film?
Was it before the film came out? No, I didn't. I might have seen a comic here or there, and I just thought it was some weird... Stay tuned. I just thought it was some weird Donald Duck ripoff. Oh, guess what? So did Disney, because they sued over it and won over it. But no, Howard was never, and still to this day, isn't anything I've cared about or knew really about. As I got into my teens and stuff like that, I feel that there's been takeoffs of Howard the Duck. Look at things like video game Conker's Bad Fur Day, things like that, which almost take the idea of Howard the Duck and reuse it in a different way so that they don't get sued. They tried to make an animated series. They have included him, obviously, in movies to various, very, very minimal extent. But no, and it's stunning that way back then, this is what somebody went ahead and went, yeah, Howard, that's the way to do it. I mean, I understand, especially when you look at this film, things like dinosaurs and some of those Jim Henson effects company type of shows that were being done with practicals, and maybe that's the reason, but this is a stretch. know, to decide what's next. What are you going to take a D-list character like Iron Man and make a movie out of him? I mean, this takes the balls to decide that you're going to take this character and then write the script that you're going to do to try to make this a hit.
Well, at least Iron Man, you could say, is a prototypical superhero. He's got an alter ego. He's got an origin story. He's got the Batman rule where he's got money, not powers. Howard the Duck is really not a superhero when you think of like what that archetype means. Now, my knowledge of him is this movie and his cameos in from like Guardians of the Galaxy on. I had never picked up a Howard the Duck comic. I've maybe seen him in one or two crossovers I've read when I've read The Defenders. He is tied into Man-Thing, which kind of makes it appropriate. I put both yeah. in the same mm-hmm. part, mm-hmm. but God, if I was running Marvel, I think there's 100 characters I would have picked before I ever got to Howard the Duck to be my first flagship.
Well, it wasn't them that picked it. It was the guy who was just coming off the biggest successful franchise of all time who picked this to make a movie out of. And it's really funny to think about that. This was a guy, George Lucas, on top of the fucking world. And 3 years after Return of the Jedi, we have this come out. And I gotta say, I want to get into this right now. When this movie was released, I had zero interest. Even though in 1986, or maybe it was 85, I remember distinctly going into a movie theater, and I look, and there's this big fucking egg with a cigar sticking out of it, and lights were all around it promoting this, and George Lucas's name was all over it. I still had zero interest. What happened was, it was on cable one night when I was a kid. I turned it on, and about half hour, well, not even that, maybe 20 minutes in, I was bored to tears and I turned it off. I did not rewatch it or try watching it again until years later. It was probably about 25 years later. I watched it and I was so distraught and so upset. I took to the Adventure Amigo site that we worked at the time, and I wrote a scathing review, which is still on my letterbox, by the way. And I promised myself I would never watch it again until we get to this series. And I was dreading going back to this because you have to think that I was a big defender of those prequels, but this was the start of it, right? This was the start of Lucas's downfall, where he was going from the creative mind behind the hugely successful Star Wars franchise to the fledgling producer who would do this, he would do Willow. I mean, this movie pretty much almost bankrupted him. It's just crazy to think about that a guy would go from Star Wars to this, which is the most fascinating thing about it, quite frankly.
Adam, this is not the first time you've seen this, correct?
I was trying to think about that. I've seen parts of this. I think this might be my first credit-to-credit viewing, because there's parts of this, especially when it gets into the second half, and especially the last third, when I'm like, I don't remember this. I don't remember this. I don't remember this. Now, then again, there were some parts of my teenage years that I don't remember whatsoever, so it's possible. I can't say why, but I don't remember this film other than the first half of the movie until this viewing.
I saw this once in high school because of morbid...
It was a dare?
Out of morbid curiosity, because forget worst comic book movies of all time. If you type in worst movies ever made, this comes up on a... Like, this is the Batman and Robin of the 80s.
Oh, absolutely.
Where it could have killed... I mean, this could have crippled Marvel before they ever got out of the starting gate.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is the kind of, like, this is the Mummy 2017 of Marvel, except they managed to actually pull themselves out of the gutter. But having said that, my curiosity was just, okay, what makes this so bad? Because even the people I know who enjoy bad movies, ironically, have next to nothing positive to say about Howard the Duck. And I was curious to rewatch this because I'm older. Maybe I just didn't get it when I was in high school. Maybe this was flew over my head. No pun intended, because I don't think ducks can... This duck doesn't fly.
Oh, it flies. Well,
on his own. On his own.
I know.
But you mentioned Lucas. Let's get into how the hell this got made. As you mentioned, George Lucas was on top of the world. He had created the most successful entrepreneurial franchise of all time with Star Wars. Now, after Return of the Jedi, he was still heavily involved in Indiana Jones, you know, Temple of Doom. He knew this director and his wife from film school.
Yeah.
They were all in the same group with Francis Ford Coppola and all of that ilk. And they co-wrote American Graffiti with Lucas. So they had worked with him before in a different capacity. And they also wrote Temple of Doom. Well, he wrote Temple of Doom. To my understanding, you know, he did some script polishing on the original Star Wars.
Yep.
But Lucas, as we saw with Empire and Jedi, he was perfectly content with no longer directing, just putting his name on projects. to emphasize that he sold off his presidency of Lucasfilm. He resigned in that role to focus on producing films. He wanted John Landis to direct this.
This is the best story. Now, to give background on John Landis, at this point, John Landis had completely destroyed the relationship between him and Spielberg after what happened with Twilight Zone, which I did another deep dive on. I looked at that accident. People go back and Google that, where there was a massive accident that killed Jennifer Jason Leigh's dad, Vic Morrow, and two kids while filming that movie. So his relationship with Spielberg was completely destroyed. His career was disgraced. Yet, George Lucas was still friends with him, put this on his table, and even a disgraced John Landis said, fuck no, I'm not going to direct that movie.
You know what? I think he made the correct decision.
Well, I mean, who knows? He probably did. He went on to work with Eddie Murphy on a few projects, but his career never really got back on track. And I agree with you. I don't think this would have put it right back on track, honestly.
And this idea for Howard the Duck, they had talked about that when American Graffiti was being made. Lucas showed... Yeah. Cats and Huck, the comic book, and he told them it was very funny. It's got film noir elements, but it's ridiculous by that title alone. So they kind of sat on it for a decade. And there is a documentary called A Look Back at Howard the Duck, where they go much more into the production history than we'll get into.
I think it's important to remember, too, at that time that was being done, you know, things like American Graffiti, A New Hope, and that, Howard the Duck was an original number one that had been put out. You know, it wasn't an existing, they weren't doing TV shows and TV movies and things like that. And it was for an irreverent, more adult-skewing comic, it was a big hit. I think that's something to note. Marvel was at that point going, we got to start making stuff for some older people. And that's kind of where Howard the Duck came. And it was, I mean, numbers are different then than they are now, you know, but its initial print run of 300,000 sold out instantly, and a book that was 75 cents was selling for $15 and $20. So the book had fans in the better part of the creative community, mentioned in Pretender songs, it's mentioned in other forms of media, because it was the first one that was like kind of geared towards that growing up comic book crowd. So it makes sense that some of these people would at least go, hey, this is something that's not cartoonish, that's more for that PG-13 that they were starting to gear towards in the film.
It's also worth noting that Howard the Duck is a 70s creation. So right around the time American Graffiti was being made, the comic had debuted. Because he's not part of the Stan Lee canon in the 60s, where he was just churning out heroes left and right. He's not of that ilk. You know, he's a decade after. So at least Lucas showed he was topical with what had debuted with Marvel. But when Landis said, fuck no, his words, they said, all right, they met with Steve Gerber, who was a writer on Howard the Duck.
A creator.
Talked about doing, yeah, he was a creator. Now, he says that he was approached at a time where Lucas was not involved, but I tend to believe this whole thing stems from George Lucas.
Yeah, and in fact, there have been differing reports, too, of how involved Lucas was with this film. Leah Thompson says that he was on set almost every day, and he even directed a few scenes. Yet, there are multiple other people who say he attached his name to it to help his friend out, which, as you've mentioned, Matt, he's known this comic for 10 years before he even started working on it, so I don't believe that. I believe Leah Thompson, where she says that he was deeply involved in the making of this.
George Lucas many times has said, hey, I want to make films for the kid in all of us. So I do believe that he would see this and say, I think there's something here that could be fun and reminds you of being a kid. The product we're going to discuss, but I absolutely see why Lucas would say, I can do something fun with this.
And this was the period, you could not have made this in the 70s, where especially American cinema was very realistic and, I don't want to say grittier, but fantasy was not in a great place in the 70s. Once you get to the 80s, you know, look at Labyrinth this year.
Labyrinth, Neverending Story, Dark Crystal. Yeah, this was the time to do a film like this. You're right.
And, you know, Labyrinth came out this year, so Lucas was busy with that. But he was involved on that, so I tend to believe he would have as much interest in this as far as visiting on set. But, you know, Labyrinth, I would classify as a kid's movie, but there's plenty in there, both with subtext and not so subtle subtext that appeals to adults. So I could see this being something that, to Lucas's point, would appeal to everybody. Universal optioned it. They partnered with Marvel. Universal said, we'll talk about this with X-Men. Hey, we need a film for the summer. And despite you guys wanting this to be an animated movie, that would cost too much money.
Oh my God. Yeah, and It's just funny. I'm sorry to interrupt that, Matt, but take into account 2 years later, his buddy Spielberg would produce a movie like this, a film noir in animated style called Who Framed Roger Rabbit that made a huge boatload of money. That would have been the way to go with this, is to go animated. I'm sorry?
Yeah, go the hybrid style where it's live-action actors interacting with animated characters.
That would have been the way to go.
I definitely think this is one of those things where Lucas just wrong place, wrong time. Maybe if this came out after Who Framed Roger Rabbit, maybe it could have been a little bit more fine-tuned. Mm-hmm. But he said, look, ILM, I'm pretty sure we can produce this in live action. And it leaves me wondering, like, let's say Jim Henson was involved in this movie. I would think that maybe at least the practical effects would be a little bit better, especially when you look at not just Labyrinth, but how they pulled off at Ninja Turtles a couple years later.
I was about ready to say, they made Turtles look like they could fucking do ninja moves. He could have done something with this, and it is so distracting to look at this puppet and look at the lips not move in sync with the fucking words and everything else. Yeah, Henson would have made that work.
Now, would Henson have been okay with the undertones of this movie and all that? I don't know, but he still made Ninja Turtles, which is considerably more violent, at least by comparison. The one excuse I will give Universal is the 80s were the dark days of animation. Disney was about to go bankrupt after the Black Cauldron. You had yet to have some of those other studios, like, you know, DreamWorks wasn't around, there was no Pixar. And when you had a Disney movie lose out to the Care Bears, that could have been the harbinger of doom for animation. So that's the one sort of caveat I would give in the corner of the studio as far as doing this animation versus live action. But my ultimate resolution would have been just punt it. Nobody was clamoring for a Howard the Duck movie. It's not like you were trying to capitalize on a fad, which in a lot of ways, this and the Garbage Pail Kids movie, I think are very, almost identical.
Good point.
Not just when it looks to the, not just about the effects, but tone, talk about the filmmaking. I think they're very much linked, much like the two sons on Tatooine.
And which make a cameo
Lucas
here.
Lucas said, you know, I've worked with dwarf actors with the Ewoks. And I'm sure Warwick Davis told him to go fuck himself when he offered him this. Yeah, this thing came out, and despite people saying that the test screenings were filled with people laughing and all that, this thing got lambasted right out of the gate. You had Siskel calling it a stupid movie, his words. You had Ebert criticizing it, everything down to the soundtrack. Leonard Maltin was very tough on it. He was one of the people saying, why'd you do this in live action? Look, the Razzies, let's not act like they're the authority on movies, but this thing won Worst Picture. This thing took a drumming, and its reputation has not improved with time.
Yeah, Under the Cherry Moon, which was Prince's movie that came out that year, was like neck and neck with this movie as far as how many Razzies it won, which, you're right, it's not the end-all be-all, but in the 80s, it was a big deal when we'd see who won the Razzies. And this movie destroyed careers. Let's not forget, we had the head of the studio who was there at the time Jaws was out. He got shit-canned after this. Thank God Leah Thompson had Some Kind of Wonderful and Tim Robbins had Bull Durham on the back burner, or they would have probably never recovered from this. Jeffrey Jones had Ferris Bueller's Day Off come out that summer. He was safe. If you didn't have something in the can right before this movie came out, your career was done. And a lot of people lost their jobs, and this destroyed a lot of careers. And George Lucas, it took a long time for him to recover from this, to the point where it took Steve Jobs to buy Pixar from him in order for him to actually financially recover and have enough money to make Phantom Menace 13 years later.
Between this and the divorce, he was in a very bad...
Yeah. Willow.
Yeah, I mean, the 80s, after Temple of Doom, it wasn't smooth sailing whatsoever. In fact, you could argue Temple of Doom was kind of the precursor. That was like the ball for Raiders of the Lost Ark just rolling downhill, getting worse and worse. Well, is this movie redeemable? That's the question we're going to answer today, because none of us have watched it in a long time, because why would you willingly go out and watch this? Not to preview my thoughts, but...
Well, it's worth it for one scene. We'll get to here in a little bit.
All right. Well, speaking of this movie, because believe it or not, we do actually have a movie to talk about on this podcast. I know, shocking. So we open not with the Marvel logo that we're so accustomed to seeing, not just with basically from X-Men on, that logo has been with some attached to something. And we open on Duck World, because Howard the Duck comes from a planet not of Earth, but a planet inhabited entirely by anthropomorphic ducks. Which, I'll give it this, that premise fits with the 80s. Like, it's not that ridiculous. I mean, it's cartoony, for sure, but it's a comic book.
Why would you not set the entire movie here? If you're going to go here, why not keep it here? There's enough weird shit going on this planet, including duck titties, which, my God, they don't even lactate. But here we have fucking duck titties. We have play duck. We have duck fucking puns galore around. Why not spend the entire movie here instead of going where it goes? The studio was like, I think it was a studio, or I don't remember who it was, that told them, you need to start somewhere where we know where the Howard comes from. And so they came up with this whole prelogue here. But yeah, it's a weird place to start, and it doesn't get much less weird.
Had to be money, because I can't imagine this thing costs surprisingly a lot.
36.
Yeah, surprisingly a lot as it is. I think if you set the whole thing on Duck World, you come close to doubling that figure, which would just, it would have, I mean, Lucasfilm as an entity would have been gone.
You know, I mentioned Garbage Pail Kids movie. Another thing I would equate this to is Masters of the Universe that was put out by Canon, where it's the exact same thing. Why is that movie not set on whatever
Eternia?
Eternia.
That tells everyone what I know about He-Man. But it's that same thing where it's like, we're here to see that. We're not here to see them get sucked into the real world. And this whole trend has permeated into the new millennium, because they did this with like the Smurfs when they did a live-action movie of them where they entered the real world. I mean, Harold and the Purple Crayon just did this. I don't understand why we keep continuing this trend in kids' movies. The only time it's really worked are the Sonic films.
I've never seen it, but I hear great things.
It's not a high bar to cross or a ring to grab, but compliment's a compliment. Because look, Howard the Duck, I mean, Sonic could have easily been Howard the Duck. If it was made at the same time that they put out that Mario Brothers movie, it very well could have been. So we're seeing, as Garrett mentioned, duck puns galore. And I have a pretty high threshold for puns, as these shows have proven. But even I was tapping out like at the WWE, just going... You know, there's everything from, of course, they sneak in a Raiders of the Lost Ark poster, you know, play duck, the TV he's flipping through. I think it's Duckweiser is the beer. Some of them are even clever. It's just putting the word duck. Like, it's not even a play on words.
This
part, oh my God.
It is starting me out on a positive note. I'm actually laughing with these. I'm smiling. And what it does is it makes me think of some of the queues in Toontown at Disneyland, and when they used to have it at Disney World, where in some of those queues you would have these posters of they'd be classic posters, but they'd be of Disney characters. They currently do this in their Runaway Railway queue. So it's making me think of that. And as much as this is not Disney, boy, it's making me think of what Disney has done since, because this is exactly what they're doing in their parks. And it's making me chuckle, it's making me laugh, even though I cannot believe how blue they get with play duck and that stuff. I mean, imagine you're taking your six-year-old to this in the 80s, and that's what pulls out in the first 3 minutes of this film.
I was so glad I did not drag my dad to the theaters, because I used to drag him to a lot of different things. In watching this, I was like, God, I don't know how somebody taking their kid to this, from the guy who did Ewoks just a few years before, plastering his name all over a movie like this, and this is the intro to his new one. It would blow my mind. I could not imagine being a parent in that situation.
I mean, this is basically the tamer version of Fritz the Cat.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Some of these do make me laugh, but... All right, so let's get into the tone of this movie, which I think is one of the... I mean, look, I could have a Ten Commandments-sized tablet of everything wrong with this movie. But I think it starts with the tone. It is very clear they don't know if they're making a Goonies-esque kids film or something that is more akin to things like Shrek and SpongeBob, where you're slipping in a lot of innuendo and adult stuff, but it just comes off as overly pervy and kind of mean-spirited and gross, if you ask me.
You touched on something I wanted to get into, and I think a big, big reason why this movie, quite frankly, does not work. There's a myriad of reasons, but it's tone. This movie's tone is everywhere. We are going to go from this to a duck-out-of-water story to a final comic book-type confrontation and a transformation into a bad guy by one of these characters. It is out of control, the tone of this movie. And I think that's what threw a lot of people off. On top of look, I know the 80s was just, it was really, really hard to do these animatronics. And I know that Lucas, he had confidence in the ILM. We've talked about it in the past where his ideas are kind of grander than what they are capable of doing. And there's a lot of things here with these duck animatronics that just don't work. And when you have them talk and you don't even see the lip sync with what they're saying. You had to go the animation route. Who cares? Delay the fucking thing. Just get everything right before you get out. But it all starts with tone, and this movie does not get that right.
I like the tone at the beginning of this because I do think it's stupid fun, and I'm okay to go along with it. I will agree, though, the movie, it doesn't know what it is throughout. The tone changes. It goes back and forth. It knows that it needs to play to kids and families, but it's going to try to be that more adulty type from the comic, but that doesn't fit with what they're selling. So it just goes so far all over the place. And you might as well have a dark overlord producing this thing because it's ridiculously inconsistent. But this opening, this part of it, I'm like, huh, for all the shitting that this movie's on, this first opening part, I'm like, okay, I'm smiling and I'm laughing along. Even when I have to see duck boobs, including duck nipples, on my screen.
Well, let's also talk about, too, the three of us discussed the Bond franchise, and this is being scored, for the most part, by John Barry, who did most of those Bond films. And so he's opening it up here with a noir-type saxophone-playing music going on, and it just doesn't fit with what's on screen when you see duck titties on the screen.
Well, no, it almost feels like we're going to get, like, Detective Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of part of the problem. He doesn't have anything. He just is. We don't know who or what, anything about him other than we get this part, we get introduced to him. It takes about, what, like 7 minutes before we even get a look at his face. And then he's whisked away, but all we know is that he's a duck. We know nothing else about Howard.
By the way, before you move on, Matt, did you guys catch the Two Moons cameo in the beginning here?
Yeah. So Howard's characterization is something we'll talk about once the movie kind of kicks into gear, because it's something I have a huge problem with. But Howard lives on this planet. He sits down in his lazy boy after a hard day of work when it is somehow propelled, not just out of his own room, but he goes across the entire apartment complex, busting into bedrooms, bathrooms, including a soaking female duck complete with anatomically correct boobs, which I could imagine parents walking out seeing that alone.
Oh, yeah. There were walkouts of Nosferatu proportions after that particular scene, I guarantee it.
And my question is why? It's explained later on, but this is a very... I will give the movie credit. It starts immediately. It doesn't make you wait for him to enter the real world, or like our world, so to speak. He gets sucked out all the way into outer space, but rest assured, ducks can breathe in outer space without a suit, apparently, and be just fine. And he lands in the most amazing place in the U.S. of A. where you can land, Cleveland.
I gotta say, though,
Cleveland.
As he's going through space on this lazy boy, I love that you at least get a voiceover that breaks down what the hell is going on or what just happened.
Oh, Adam, you like that?
No. For anybody that watches Marvel's What If animated series, I swear to God, this is almost the exact same intro, almost word for word, that they use on What If. And I'm just like, holy shit, I don't think Marvel realizes they ripped off this about different worlds and galaxies and different worlds exist and what if they were brought to ours. Like, I'm ready for I Am the Watcher. It absolutely made me laugh because I'm watching those. Yeah, I'm laughing along and I'm smiling. It's cheesy as all hell, but I just watched an anthropomorphic duck fly through space on a lazy boy.
Yeah, it's so cheesy that he should have been a mouse instead of a duck. Disney would have had a lawsuit earlier out than they already did. Howard lands in Cleveland. He's walking around. People take this very calmly, though, that they're seeing an anthropomorphic duck, for all things considered. But I guess that's like the fifth most surprising thing you would find in Cleveland in the 80s.
Well, that's just it. That's a big thing I noticed while watching it this time, is nobody's responding to the fact that this duck is a foul-mouthed fucking creature that's walking and talking. We're going to get to the main character here in a bit, but nobody responds to how weird this is. It's just taken as, oh, here's a duck that talks. So what are you doing later on? No response to it whatsoever, which blew my mind watching it this time.
That's also one of the problems where it kind of breaks any semblance of reality that you can have with the movie because people are way too accepting of this. And you get a lot of mileage out of just different people's reactions and him having to adjust. But right from this opening scene, or first scene on Earth, where he sees a woman being attacked by thugs and he scares them off with whack foo, or duck foo, whatever he calls it.
Quack foo.
Quack foo.
Quack foo.
Which is his only superpower in the comic, from what I heard.
Yeah, because Marvel's going to pantheon of martial artists, but apparently Howard the Duck trumps them all. So he rescues the woman, Beverly, played by Leah Thompson, who's top billed in this movie, because...
Oh, nice!
I told you some of my puns can be very clever.
That is very clever, I'll give you that. Leah Thompson, fresh off Back to the Future, but there were a couple of other people who were up for this. One was Belinda Carlisle, who was completely heartbroken she didn't get it until she saw the movie and she was like, oh, that kind of saved me. And Adam, you and I have a big affinity for the next one. I know you want to talk about that one.
Of all people, Miss Piano Queen herself, Tori Amos, who was a club singer with her band Why Can't Tori Read, really wanted this. And if you can find that bootleg version, of which I have a few, she looks like Beverly does in this film, with the teased red hair, the outfit, everything. And it's amazing that Belinda Carlisle and Tori Amos, which if Belinda Carlisle auditioned, I only have to assume that Tiffany did as well. And all these female singers, not a single one of them ended up being an actress. You know, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Leah Thompson herself regrets being in this movie.
She did for a
She's
while,
embraced it.
But lately,
yeah.
She is like, you know what, fuck it, it's fun, and I have relationships with people. Because you look at some of the talent that came out of this film, and thank goodness, as you mentioned at the beginning, they had other work, but you got some people who did some good stuff after this. And at least, thank God she recovered from it, because I love Leah Thompson.
Yeah, she ran from it for a long time, and I think there was a screening of it, I want to say in 2014, that she attended, and I think she's embraced it in recent years. And she's also said if it wasn't for this movie, she wouldn't have met her husband and had the kid, her two beautiful children, because she went on to do, like I said, Some Kind of Wonderful, where she met her husband at that time. She's embraced it lately, but yeah, there was a time when, if you mentioned this in an interview, she would run for the fucking hills.
I think that was it. I think she was getting invited to screenings like every year, and it was always a joke. And then one year she showed up, and it just kind of changed the public perception, and good for her.
I could see some of the appeal for this because George Lucas had a name, and there was a period in the 80s where we were desperately trying to find the it girl of it girls, you know, Daryl Hannah, Meg Ryan. People thought it was going to be Leah Thompson, Jennifer Connelly. There was a lot of competition at the time to be the top girl in that demographic.
Yeah, and Jennifer Connelly also went up for this, and she also did not get it. But you mentioned the name George Lucas, and I think that was a big appeal for Tim Robbins. Tim Robbins got this without having done much, but he was excited because he was doing the new George Lucas project, and it had a lot of clout and a lot of name. But then at some point, Leah Thompson and Tim Robbins kind of looked at each other like, is this going to come out okay? Like, they started having doubts halfway into this production. And I guess when you have to fake having sex with a fucking duck, I guess that's when you have to really reassess your career choices.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. But right away, Howard is such an unlikable prick because he rescues her and she says, thank you, you're welcome to spend the night since you're, I take you enough around here. And all he does is bitch and moan. I want to go home.
Yeah.
Like, he has no courtesy whatsoever. And there is something to be said, like, if you made him just very sardonic, almost like Garfield-esque, where he has a persona of being sarcastic and a bit of an asshole, but he's got a heart. I don't get the sense Howard has a heart.
No, and I think that's part of the problem, is Howard is so poorly characterized that you want to be on the side of him. Or at least you have to be on the side of Beverly. And you're on her side because she's cute and singing and everything else, but it's hard to like Howard in this film. And I think that's one of the big problems at the beginning.
Well, from what I hear, as unlikable as he is here, he is even worse in the comic. And I think that was a big part of Gerber's problem, was he was, in his mind, too likable. Because he is just a sardonic prick.
Yeah, no, he's a dick in the comic. Like I mentioned at the beginning, Conker's bad fur dick, because it's that exact characterization. It's why Ninja Turtles, you read that original series, or you read things like The Last Ronin, and it's completely different than what most people know from animated Turtles that most people realize. You have to go one way or the other. Either make them like the comic, or make them for a kiddie movie, and this does neither one very well.
Yeah, and he has no motivation beyond, I want to go home, which, if you really introduced me to his world and how important it is to him, the status quo there, maybe I could have some degree of sympathy for his plight here. Because, you know, he didn't ask for any of this, so on that level I feel bad for him. But because he meets every opportunity with just pure pessimism, it makes me hard to root for him whatsoever.
We don't see anything back at Duck World. If we knew there was someone there, show us a picture of someone on his mantle, and he talked about needing to go home to someone. Even his sacrifice at the end means something.
They give you an in to do that because his mom leaves. They do the Batman Returns thing with the answering machine.
Yeah. But
it's the mom. It's like a friend who he plays like ball with. So there's breadcrumbs there for him to have an attachment to his world. But because we never cut back there, it just feels disparate. Like, I forgot that we actually see Duck World at any point because it's only in that one scene. But Beverly, nevertheless, takes Howard to her apartment and lets him spend the night. The following day, she takes him to Phil Blumbert, who we believe to be a scientist, played by the aforementioned Tim Robbins. His first movie, as you mentioned, this is a guy who would go on to do The Shawshank Redemption. He'd win an Oscar for Mystic River. And this is, for Tim Robbins, what Batman Forever is for Tommy Lee Jones, where he is cranking it up to 11 so much that it is grating to watch.
It really is. Yeah, and Tim Robbins isn't somebody I have an affiliation for personally, but I do have a lot of respect for his acting ability and in the right role. And we'll talk about Shawshank in a number of years. He can be fantastic. And here, you're absolutely right. He's turning it way up. And it's almost like every time he's on screen, mostly everything else in this movie, I just kind of put my head in my hands and I'm like, oh, why? But as long as we're talking about casting, let's talk about Howard. Guys, wouldn't it be perfect casting to put Danny DeVito in this fucking costume? Why did they have to go to the point where they went for kids and little people to fit in this costume when you had Danny DeVito right there?
Well, DeVito notwithstanding, let's talk about someone who's very connected with Danny DeVito, Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
He was asked to do the voiceover for Howard, obviously not playing in the suit. Did it for about a week and said, fuck this, because they couldn't get the mouth to match. Now, granted, I think part of this is Robin Williams not sticking to the script, but this really called for a Robin Williams or a Steve Martin, even a Chevy Chase. I think his Fletch persona would match Howard. But as it stands, Tim Robbins' performance, he is playing this like he's in a children's film. He's playing this almost like you would see on Sesame Street, which I can respect, but that's also in large part not the tone of this overall movie. And I would give it a little bit more of a pass if he was younger. Like, if he was like a teenager or a 20-something-year-old, I don't think I'd be as bothered by it. But
yeah.
I hate him so much in this movie.
I'm with you.
I think the jury's about to give the defense.
Uh-oh. Adam.
Because Adam's been very quiet.
Yeah, he has.
I can't defend this performance. It, you know what? Oh, this is why, as much as I love Bull Durham, I can't stand him in it. Because he gives this same performance in Bull Durham. Dad, don't come at me, people. He's not the star of that film. But this wide-eyed, oh, woe is me, that version of Tim Robbins, I can't stand. It's amazing. This is an Oscar winner, multiple-time Academy Award nominee that does great work later. And I'm glad he stuck with the craft, but damn, this is hard to watch. And yeah, to your point, he's 15 years too old to be this assistant working here at this zoo or business park or wherever it is they decided to go to for this.
It's a museum. It's a curated museum. It almost looks like the Smithsonian.
No, what it looks like is L.A. County Museum, because I swear that's where these interiors are filmed, because I've been there.
Yeah, I mean, the intern should have been the one directing this movie. It probably would not have made much of a difference. Because they're trying to get an answer of what Howard is, where he comes from, but as they're walking him out, they find out that Phil is only a lab assistant. He's not even a full scientist. To which Howard basically, if this movie was allowed to say the word fuck, he would have told them to F off right there.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the directing. Let's talk about that. Willard Huck is the one directing this film. It feels like somebody strong-armed into doing something that he didn't really have much confidence in him actually being able to do. He feels way overwhelmed here. And I think that has a lot to do with the tone that is shifted everywhere in the course of just the first 30 minutes or so that we've discussed. Willard Huck was definitely not the one to do this. I don't know if anybody could have done this. I don't even know if you could have put Jim Henson in the director's chair, or even Frank Oz, who does good work when it comes to puppetry, if it could come off any better than what Huck pulls off here.
And he's also the co-writer, him and his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at that point, I mean, if you're like, hey, would you like to come on board this George Lucas production to write and direct this film? You say yes. So he doesn't do a good job, but there's nothing in this that's done well. I won't say nothing, but I don't think anybody says no to this opportunity.
You're right.
Yeah, and to quote another 80s, early 90s movie, I think there's a less than zero chance of things that are good.
Yeah.
I don't think Robert Downey Sr. could have directed this movie and it would have been good.
No.
Oh, in keeping in vain with things that could only happen in the 80s in a PG movie, Howard looking for employment, and he winds up in a brothel. I blanked on this
my goodness.
Completely.
This is insane. Not to mention, have we had the bedroom scene with those two?
Oh,
with,
that's not till later.
Not yet.
That's not till later? Okay, let's talk about this then. Guys, this isn't even a PG-13 movie. Just a couple years earlier, Gremlins and Temple of Doom caused such a stir, they moved the rating up to PG-13. I don't know who was smoking what in the ratings board. When you watch this movie, how the hell do you give this a PG rating?
I have an answer.
He is cleaning cum in a fucking brothel. Like, how much more vain and disgusting can you get?
Well, the answer is because here in America, we will always turn a blind eye to abhorrent sexuality in movies, but God forbid you shoot someone with a gun, because there's really nobody gets shot in this movie. Even the big villain, it's a freaking techno laser show. So I think that's why. Remember, the PG-13 rating got created out of violence, not because of sexuality.
True, but there was a different attitude towards sexuality around this time, and I guess that kind of evolved. I guess I'm kind of wrong on that. Where it started off about violence, but eventually you could show tits on screen, but you couldn't show anything else, and then it just kind of turned around at one point.
Yeah, I think once you get to the 90s, that starts to become a little bit more balanced, where I would say basically from the early 90s up until Columbine, we were much more of that style, but I think once Columbine happened, we sort of flipped the other way again. But yeah, you're right. Him working at a brothel and it being as... they don't hide it. Like, you literally see the name of it. You see see people fucking in the tubs and everything.
And just not to mention how he got here. He's about ready to bite this chick's ass before she puts the fucking workbook in his bill. Like, oh my God. I couldn't believe the shit I was seeing as I was watching this.
Cue Al Pacino, because Howard likes a fat ass.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Howard, you know, he's working here, but he quits by knocking his boss into a very, very dirty tub and denouncing he quits. So he couldn't even hold a job for longer than a day, for all accounts, because I get the sense this movie takes place in the span of 48 hours.
And as a kid, I don't think about this, but I'm watching it now. I'm like, does he have a social security number? How does he get a job?
Does he have a bank account?
Do you have a bank account? Exactly.
This is why people are yelling about E-Verify. You know, you get these foreigners coming over from Duck World. Taking a jizz mop of jobs.
Yeah, his name's not L. Howard, let's remember. So he returns to the club where Beverly's singing, a band called Cherry Bomb, which, you know, they couldn't have been caught dead doing the soundtrack for this movie. Although they do the title song at the end, which I'm sure was very high on the Billboard 500.
They do. And you know what? This band is filled with people who would go on. We had KB Sigal's twin sister. She's in this band. As well as Holly Robinson Pete, who would go on to do a number of things. We have people here. We actually have these band members. Actually, they would go on to things. But yeah, Cherry Bomb, obviously a take on the Runaways. And Adam, I guess you didn't read the comic. I mean, is this based off the comic? Is she actually a rock star in the comic?
None that I know of. It's funny you bring up
that. Research on that. She's an artist model. Yeah, they made it less pervy, which was, I can't believe it's possible in this type of movie.
Right.
I'm going to say two things. It's funny you bring up Katie Sagal's sister, who's in this. Because for those that don't know, Katie Sagal tours as a singer, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's my Peggy Bundy and Leela. But I'm going to say, I love every time I'm listening to these ladies sing. This kind of music throughout, I'm digging it. I'm digging it a lot.
I'm okay with it because no one's telling quote-unquote jokes. It's like a reprieve. It's literally a musical reprieve from this abhorrent script.
Adam, you'll be happy to know that I included one on the intro.
Which, I gotta say, for all the stuff we're complaining and like this brothel scene, this movie's an hour and 50 minutes.
It feels longer.
Yeah.
This movie,
it feels like an eternity.
It does, but it does not need to be. It's inexcusable that they put an almost 2-hour movie up on screen, because God knows there's a lot of stuff to trim. You know, you can pull the feathers out of this duck and still hit your mandated time, but it is inexcusable that they wrote something that ran almost 2 hours, especially in the 80s for Howard the Duck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this thing needed to be defeathered, plucked, boned, thrown in the oven, eaten, and then shit out, and I could have done that in less than 2 hours between prep, consumption, and exsumption. We're 45 minutes into this movie, and I'm sitting in my couch going, this is just as bad as I remember.
Yeah, same here. I was watching, and, you know, I never do this, but it was my night off, and Jen had already gone to bed. I'm watching this for this particular show. Peek behind the curtain, we were going to record this a couple days ago when we did one of the Lethal Weapon films. So I've watched, and I'm like, I had a night off, and I think I came across the part where he applies for this brothel job. I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to start drinking. And I never drink during these. I want to have a clear head as I take notes and get ready to talk about these movies, but I had to make a few fucking Woodford Cokes to get through this fucker.
Yeah, and I'm sure people were doing coke as they were writing the they were writing the lines as they were doing lines.
While they were writing it, directing it, acting in it, editing it,
producing it.
So Howard realizes their manager is not being entirely upfront with their wages, so we get a bar fight in this movie, and it's about as well choreographed as one you would expect with a puppet this bad.
You mentioned Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. How did they make those puppets look so realistic? I mean, granted, it's a few years later, but I know you gotta get the one thing that Howard does in the comics in this film, but the use of this quack foo is beyond bizarre.
Bizarre when he's trying to fight and do that stuff. Other than that, I really like the look of Howard. I don't just kind of like the look of him. I like it a lot. And maybe it's because, yeah, I love that 90s Turtles, and I loved watching Dinosaurs, and it makes me think of that. I mentioned that for like the third time. But that's the feeling I get out of this. I don't have a problem with the lips, not the beak, not necessarily syncing up, because it's a duck. It's a whatever. He was too coked out of his mind to do his job right. But I don't mind the way that Howard looks. I kind of dig it.
Is this the way you guys felt when I was reaching for compliments on the Children of the Corn series?
No, nothing feels like that.
Dumbfounded by that last series. Fucking...
No, I'm not at that point yet, because this is movie number one. And unlike Children of the Corn, there's nowhere to go but up from here. What goes up must come down, because Howard knocks out their manager, and he manages to win this bar fight and takes Beverly backstage, back to her apartment, where if... I'd say there's almost bestiality in a PG movie.
Oh my god. Before that, she opens his wallet and there's a condom in his wallet.
This movie is...
That's the rapper. Come on, Howard.
How is Jeffrey Jones the least perverted thing in the movie?
We have the Mallard card instead of a MasterCard. They are going all out with the puns here. And I am dumbfounded.
That made me laugh in a Batman Forever kind of way. Because to me, that was no different than the Bat... Yeah, to me, that was no different than the Bat MasterCard.
But you know what? I'll say this. I want to go all out of limb on this. I don't give a shit at this point. I've never thought of Lea Thompson as a sex pot. I remember her in Back to the Future. She was really cute, whatnot. She's always been just one of those really cute, really adorable people that you could see as the girl next door. But when she's in these panties on this bed, my fucking God. I'm like, God damn it. I was jealous of Howard at that point watching this movie.
Yeah, my quack foo started kicking in as well. I gotta say, I'll second that. My bill rose.
Howard's fucking hair wasn't the only thing that was standing up at that part.
Is this like when Jennifer Connelly made The Rocketeer?
Oh, I thought you were going to say career opportunities when she's riding that horse.
Oh, that too. Well, it's both kidding here. And this is where they're doing the Indian Windows hardware. The fact is on his head stand up. He's trying to talk out of it. By saying like a...
And you have to think that that was a Lucas idea. You have to think like, yeah, this would happen. He would have the feather stand up on his head. I can't do the impression like you guys can. You have to think that he's on set saying, we have to do this.
I picture him just sitting, pitching this movie going, Howard's a funnier character than we've ever had before. You know that came up somewhere in the conversation. Howard gets cock-blocked, though, by Jeffrey Jones, of all people, which there's a lot of jokes I can make about that.
Oh, my God. How are we reviewing him twice in 6 months, is my question. Three times in six months, actually. It's crazy, between this and Beetlejuice.
No John Hughes retrospective yet. You know, Ferris Bueller was right before this, so people knew.
It was after. It came out a couple months after.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, it was a summer movie.
Oh, he got this because of Amadeus, which, yeah, you go from a Best Picture winner, an Oscar winner, to a Razzie winner, so I guess he's consistent on that front. I feel like he's the only person I will remotely defend on a performance, because he's doing what he's asked to do.
You know, I hate to do it.
His energy, it's maximum overdrive in a bad way.
Yeah. You know what? I hate to do it, but I have that in my notes as well. I completely agree with you. I think he's the only one who kind of gets what he's doing.
Like, if you're asking someone to play, like, a interdimensional being, possession, over-the-top, almost Power Rangers-esque villain, I think he got the assignment and did a B job. You know, I hate saying that, because this movie is awful, and everything with his character is, he's just here to get possessed, but...
And he's an awful person, but I'm watching the movie, and when he's asked to do things later, especially later, where I'm like, wow, he actually rose to the occasion.
I'm going to be the odd duck out. I can go and have fun with almost everything else that's going on, as stupid as it is. I hate everything having to do with Jeffrey Jones in this film. And I just, every time he's a part of what's on screen, I'm just like, I wish it would have stopped right here. You could make 45 minutes and I could have enjoyed it. The longer it goes, because he doesn't come until halfway part of the film. And I hate that it's hijacked from this point on.
You're going with all the duck puns. You're going with every awful fucking scene we have mentioned in the last 45 minutes or so.
Character. more than I
You know. Go with Tim Robbins' character more. You cannot go when this character comes in. Adam, my friend, how have we remained friends?
Well, this also starts the problem of this movie has dead baggage with bringing Tim Robbins and Leah Thompson along for the entire duration, where it's like, okay, at least you could say, all right, Howard is meeting a different person in every act, but they're just tag-alongs. It becomes a friggin' road trip movie by the end. Not just because they stop at a diner in about 30 minutes, but... So Jeffrey Jones plays a scientist, he's got two other colleagues with him, and this is where the movie actually bothers to explain how Howard is here, where they drive and they mention that they have a laser spectroscope that was aimed at Howard's planet, which, by the way, this movie proves that aliens exist, Earth, so maybe this crosses over with, like, Ben in Black in a decade, and that he was teleported to Earth when they activated it. And they say, well, they theorize that Howard can be sent back to his world if they just reverse the process. This is the crossing the streams excuse of, well, I guess if we do the opposite, it's going to work.
I will say, this is the most Marvel thing in this entire movie. We got laser and bright shiny shit in the sky to explain what the hell's going on.
You're right about that.
So they go to the laboratory, and because it's a Marvel movie, they got this right. Science gone wrong, which is a hallmark of almost, I mean, go down the list. Spider-Man, the Hulk, Fantastic Four, insert supervillain here. Science experiments gone awry, causing bad things to happen. That's a cliche in Marvel at this point.
Would be funny to completely redo this and put Howard Stark at the controls of this laser.
They probably would. And you know, it's funny you mention that, guys. I didn't put it together till now, but for everything we can ding this movie on, and my God, this thing is a duck in a fucking duck hunting contest with how much we have shot at it. But I will say, it gets a lot of the template for what we'll see years and years later right with the plot and everything else that has to do with the science gone wrong, as you mentioned, Matt. I couldn't believe how much of a Marvel movie it was when I watched it this time.
The blueprints are here, and I'll give the movie this compliment. At least they're not completely abandoning, I mean, look, a movie with a talking duck, that's a ridiculous premise. But they're not at least ashamed of that. Like, they're embracing the absurdity of it. And there is a certain amount of admiration I have. Because, look, we'll talk about plenty of superhero movies in Marvel where it's almost like the filmmakers were ashamed they were making a Marvel movie and kind of hid those elements to be more, you know, quote-unquote artistic. And I'll definitely have words when we get to those. So, they fire the laser, you know, speaking of James Bond, maybe they convinced John Barry this was Never Say Never Again, and that's why he did it. It's like, oh, it's an unofficial Bond movie.
Well, yeah, and then they decided to just completely shit-can his score that he did for the end of the film, and they replaced it with somebody else's.
Yeah, from what I heard, it was pretty pissed. So not only does the machine malfunction, but it looks like it brought something else back with it, as Dr. Jennings starts to act pretty funny for the rest of the movie, almost like he's possessed. And I get the sense somebody watched Ghostbusters right before they started filming, because now we got fucking Zool.
Dude, not just because we reviewed a Ghostbusters movie last year, but I thought of that as I was watching this. I feel like that's exactly the template they use for this, is Ghostbusters had come out 2 years before. Let's do that exact thing. My God, I couldn't believe how similar it was.
Adam, did you make that connection, or were you too busy enjoying this movie?
I didn't make that connection until just now, but oh my God, you're right. Yeah, he's the Keymaster.
Yeah, I guess the gatekeeper was the FBI. So they visit a diner, and he tells them that he is now the Dark Overlord of the universe, which I think is what most people call Kevin Feige nowadays. They stop at, like, cheap truck stop diner, and he demonstrates he's got, so he's Stephen King, he becomes Carrie, where he can start moving stuff telekinetically.
Cracks me up that you could tell they're taking a shot at how stuff started to change, because this truck stop diner changes its Jim Bob's barbecue and sushi, which just made me laugh.
So I have to give credit. The one joke that made me laugh is when Howard sees eggs on his plate. That was the one gag that actually made me laugh. What is it with this movie where, like, every new place they enter that has a crowd, a fight breaks out? This, the alley, bar, like, Howard is walking death.
Yeah.
Except nobody reacts, and people are so dumb where they're like, oh, that's a cute costume. I'm like, nobody is that skilled, and it would be funnier if they always called out how shitty the costume is.
Well, they kind of do. At one point, a set of guys look for the zipper on the back of them. They do kind of call that out.
Oh, that's right, because he gets patted down.
Yeah.
Play it up like he's about to be raped.
Which, if you set this at Halloween, you could have fun in that E.T. type of way, where it's just a costume.
This is one of those where Spielberg said, George, you got this.
Rather deal with Bruce.
Oh, jeez.
Howard's about to be killed by this sushi chef who also works at this diner, but the Dark Overlord has full power, destroys the diner, and because it's a third act plot point and a requirement almost, because she's here, Beverly gets kidnapped.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, this is not just Marvel Comics. I mean, this goes back to everything from Dudley Do-Right and Popeye. This is a cliche and just fantasy.
Yeah, we talked about it with Superman, too.
So because he's already been arrested, Howard finds Phil in the back of a cop car. And I get he's an intern, but they write him like he's mentally challenged, where he just crawls out the front door. I'm like, okay, this would be funny if he was 13, but it's a grown-ass man. And I'm sorry, Tim Robbins is like 6'5". He's not fitting through that door, that window. And it was like 25 years later, he's being Green Lantern, and we have to argue about which is the worst comic book movie.
Holy shit, that's right.
That's right. I forgot he was in that.
Oh, he needs a redemption.
Damn. Oh,
he got
he
one.
Needs a Shawshank redemption. Yeah.
He needs a real one. Let's be honest. Although he's not like he could play a superhero. He's pushing 70.
They got Ford in one.
Yeah, that's true. We'll see how that turns out. Ford finds Phil, and they manage to discover an old... I think I saw this movie with Anna Paquin and Jeff Daniels in the 90s. I mean, this is the mother of all coincidences, where they find this fucking almost fully functional aircraft.
Yeah, let's talk about this. Look, we've mentioned the movie's tone is everywhere. But for the most part, it's kind of been telling this linear story. Once we get the possession angle, this movie, if it wasn't already, turns into a fucking mess. Because now we have Howard flying with Tim Robbins. We have Beverly being kidnapped. We have the ongoing stand-up hair of Jeffrey Jones as he becomes possessed. Everything is going on at the same time, and it's so fucking jumbled. Willard Huck is so over his head with story beats that it just goes everywhere, and you don't know which one is up, and the movie becomes almost impossible to follow. At one point, I paused it, and I put my iPad down, and I paced for 5 minutes because I had to catch up with my thoughts on what the hell was happening.
And this would work if this was more like childlike wonderment. Maybe this needed the E.T. music.
Well, E.T. music can save anything. I'm very convinced of that.
Why isn't Howard's sidekick a kid? Because that was the thing they did in the 80s all the time. Maybe I don't want to give it a pass, but I feel like it would mesh better if Howard was stuck with a kid.
You know what? They were in a museum. If he would have picked up a kid that just followed him along the way because he was enamored with this duck, he can act just as autistic as Tim Robbins is acting in this film.
He's this close to going full retard.
Yeah.
Mm.
But this is another. It's like that Bordello scene. This next 5 minutes, not the entire thing. And this is 10 minutes of them flying this shit.
Yeah.
To no purpose whatsoever.
It's only here to pay off the whole joke about duck hunting season earlier in the movie.
Yeah, which is the only time they get Cleveland right, is when they show these fucking rubes sitting and duck hunting and all that. I did kind of giggle at that.
So they're doing with Jeffrey Jones basically what they did with Vincent D'Onofrio in the first Men in Black. Where he's like,
oh yeah,
he's like degrading and he's possessed. The difference is Vincent D'Onofrio is actually really funny in that movie, and the effects of that are a lot better than the effects here. Yeah. I know that one had
Rick,
Rick Baker, but still.
Yeah, to be determined another day. But I was pretty annoyed at this point. I'm not going to say I went with the movie because I really didn't. It was too stupid to go along with. And as you guys mentioned, Howard is just a despicable fucking character that I could give two shits about. But at this point, when the whole Marvelness of it kicks in with 1986 effects, I was pretty tuned out, guys.
Oh, I'm praying for the movie to be over, and then I'm like, oh my god, it's another 20 minutes.
Yeah, I can't believe how long this keeps going, because I'm done. I want this to be over so bad. I'm having, I don't want to say fun, but I'm at least not pissed off throughout the first little bit. I'm pissed at this point. I can't believe this keeps going. I can't believe they find an excuse for this thing to not be over yet.
Well, the reason it's as long as it is because these scenes go on, that, like, there's no editing.
Somebody call Marcia. I don't care if you're divorced. Call Marcia and have her fix this one, too.
Because all you need to do to explain how they get there is just show them, as dumb as it is, you show the aircraft, and 10 seconds later, you cut to them at the laboratory. We don't need to see 10 minutes of them actually getting there, and Tim Robbins being dunked in and out of the water. Ugh, Jeff, God, just, I don't know what this movie wants to achieve outside of testing my patience. So they get to the laboratory in the Dark Overlord, because we got to get this trope in here. He's going to transfer another Louis Tully, basically, with Beverly. And we got the ticking clock where they have to shut off the laser before the other demon overlords show up. And they seemingly destroy it with a immediately prepped neutron disintegrator, which, of course, because it's a comic movie, that's never been tested.
Shit.
So they shoot at it, and Jennings is returned to normal, but then we see the, in all of its quote-unquote stop-motion glory, what the true Overlord looks like, and this breaks the cardinal rule of, call it the Pennywise model, of I don't need to see what the monster really looks like, because I'm probably going to be disappointed.
I was having flashes to the Rancor while watching this, and I know Phil Tippett worked on both, but the way this thing moves and everything, it really gave me a huge Ray Harryhausen feel, which I know some people really dig, but when I'm trying to get into my, you know, into a film that's telling a fantastical story, and you're asking it to intermingle with humans, it doesn't look right at all. And if I wasn't annoyed already, just seeing this thing tumble around on these big bridges and everything else, I was, again, just completely tuned out.
You know what this is, right? This is He Who Walks Behind the Rose.
Oh, no. We'll get to that later. Bring it right back to that, huh?
I can't believe how bad this thing looks. This is an embarrassment. The design itself, okay, whatever. I get it. The matting, the color, the lighting being different. Just every bit of how this looks is worse than 1983 original version Rancor. This is bad. So bad.
And nothing else in the movie is with stop motion, so it makes it stand out even more.
Yeah, great point.
Like, it's almost like they got multiple effects houses to come in and work on this.
No, this was Lucas's one and only. And you know what? I'm not going to denounce them too much. Look, they had what they had. And as we've mentioned, Lucas takes half-court shots when he should just stay at the three-point line. And this is one of those examples of, even if you would have had him be possessed, that's fine. You don't have to bring it into this huge stop-motion creature, which raised the budget and raised the losses of the film in the end.
I call it the sunken cost fallacy. They're just like, all right, just keep like that pile of money that the Joker burns.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
The Howard fires the first you don't succeed, shoot him again. He destroys the monster, but by doing so, he also destroys the laser spectrograph. So while the monsters cannot transport to Earth, Howard cannot return home, which is supposed to be the sad, tragic thing of the movie, but it drops like that dead weight they throw over on Riggs' neck in Lethal Weapon 2.
We don't care about where he came from. We haven't seen it other than the beginning. He doesn't seem to care about it other than in random talking about it. So what do we care? We needed to know that something was there back with him on Duck World. But an hour and 50 minutes into this film, I don't think I'm going to give a shit what's back in Duck World.
Right.
Yeah, I'm at the point where it's like, oh, now you're trying to tug on my heartstrings? Go fuck yourself. So Howard says, all right, what am I going to do? So instead, he becomes Beverly's manager. Hires Phil to work as a roadie, which he's also not qualified for, as the band Cherry Bomb performs the song named after the title character and performs on stage as credits roll, but the movie does not cut to black for some time.
Yeah, it plays the entire song along with the credits.
We got a full concert, which is about as long as the plane ride in this movie, or at least it feels like it.
Right. This is the intro to this podcast, is this particular song. And you know what? I'll go with Adam on this. This is pretty catchy.
I was going to ask if I'm the only one singing along to Howard
the Duck. No, it's hard not to.
I feel like my own joy was sucked out. Because I'm the Grinch by the time this movie's over. I'm pissed, quite frankly.
It hurts.
Speaking of being pissed off, I'm sure that's what the producers were when they saw the returns on this movie.
Well, Gloria Katz will say that the test screenings went well. And then they got test screened in front of executives at Warner Brothers. And apparently, there's a rumor going around that the fist fight broke out between two executives over who actually greenlit this fucking movie.
And they said that the ending was purposely left open for a sequel. But for obvious reasons, that sequel never materialized, as emphasized by the 1 hour and 50 minutes that we watched Howard the Duck. So, scale of 1 to 10. Let's see if our cumulative score actually equals 10. Garrett, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Howard the Duck?
Oh, Howard the Duck. Well, Ernest Saves Christmas, Soul Man, famously, Superman 3. There are bad movies that I like over the course of time. And I can go with a lot of bad, especially 80s movies, because nostalgia's real with me. If I felt something while watching that movie, I can very easily go back to it. That's honestly a reason why I liked Superman 3 when we talked about that movie, and I annoyed Matt to no end with how much I was praising it. This I have zero love for. And in watching this film, I was baffled by each and every decision. I was baffled that George Lucas found enough in this to put his name behind it. I was baffled that a studio would pay money for it. But at the same time, it sets a lot of what we're going to be discussing in the oncoming years. We have templates for a lot of things the dreaded portal in the sky that Matt hates so much. A character changing into an evil bad guy. A damsel that the quote-unquote hero meets and has to save at the end. There are so many things that this movie establishes, but a big issue is it deserved every bit of flack it got in 1986 and on because the shifted tone in this movie. It causes joylessness by the end because there's so much bad I can go with. But when you tell a story like this and the way it is told in this, it becomes unwatchable. And that's exactly what this movie was. Tim Robbins didn't know what movie he was in. Leah Thompson, bless her heart, tried to win an Oscar for having sex with a duck in the course of this movie. The only one who gets it is a despicable man whose name I think has been mentioned already too much on this podcast. So on that end, and look, it establishes what it establishes, but I will never watch this again. I will say it's probably a little higher praise than I gave when I originally reviewed it way back when I was at the Adventure Amigos, but it's still a 3 on 10. There's so much to not like, and I don't know how it has gained the cult following that it has, but it's like Masters of the Universe, where I was so let down by Masters of the Universe when it originally came out that I swore I would never watch it again. I don't think I'll ever watch this again. So 3 out of 10 for Howard the Duck.
All right, well, to use the basketball analogy, he scored a 3 and cut the lead down to 42. Adam, scale of 1 to 10, what about you?
Boy, you know, it's amazing knowing that this was going to start it off, and I was like, man, I know some people really enjoy this, and it's got a cult following. It's not going to be as bad as some of what people talked about before Revisionist History, is it? Yeah, it really is. The notoriety of Playboy and duck titties and duck condoms and pseudo bestiality. It's all here, and it's here in a PG film. I understand what Lucas was hoping to get out of this film, but apparently he was still mired in depression, and this is the result of it. Oof. I've said, you know, the things that I like. I enjoy Leah Thompson in this movie. I think she has fun. I think she looks great. I think she's a doll, to Garrett's point. I think she looks adorable. I think she's right for this film. Jim Robbins is laughable. Jeff, I mean, saying his name, I can't go with that. I enjoy how words look in this. I think they actually do a nice job with the animatronics. I enjoy it. I applaud what they do, as limited as it was. But you almost had a watchable first 45 minutes where he gets there, he meets the girl, he becomes her manager, and he gets a laser, and he goes home. Boom, done. 45 minutes in and out, you got a complete movie. But then you got a second half, and the second half drives off a cliff, throws you out into space, and I get eaten by the Dark Overlord. And man, this tone is all over the place. Characterizations are all over the place. Quality is non-existent. And editing, I think they forgot to edit this film. I think they turned in a cut, and they went, first print, done. Shoot it. Send it to theaters, because there is no editing. Oof, man, this thing is a hard watch. If you love this film, good for you. I can't. And I was of the ilk where you would think that my childhood would be back. And with all the good graces I can give this movie, I can't give the score greater than a 4. So that's what I'm going to give it. I'm going to give it GC's Classic 4 on 10 for the little bit that I enjoyed only in the first half of the film.
All right. Well, my score is different, so we're going to have 3 different scores on this show. You know, we've covered some pretty infamous movies. I mean, we did Batman, Robin, and Catwoman already. We've done Superman 4. We've done Superman 3. To some people, we've done Batman v Superman, because some people consider that one of the worst movies ever made. And I think this movie's up there with Batman and Robin and Catwoman. It is amazing that this did not crater Marvel's career. Part of that can also be attributed to the fact that by the late 80s rolled around, Marvel was about to go bankrupt, and they would sell off all their characters, which is how we will get to where we ended up in a decade from now. But in a decade defined by fantasy and the more absurd elements of filmmaking starting to make a resurgence, this failed to capitalize on that. It's not incompetent, because it's in focus, and narratively it's at least coherent. You know, this movie is not overly complicated. But with superhero movies, with Marvel properties, you gotta give me a likable protagonist. You can have characters that are arrogant and, on the surface, unlikable. And we'll talk about this with Iron Man, with Doctor Strange. There are characters that you really should not like, and that should not procure you from making a movie by any means, but there's nothing redeemable about Howard as a protagonist, outside of the fact that he knows duck foo. So I found this to be a slog to get through. This made an hour and 50 minutes feel like 5 hours. I'm going to go lower than both of you guys. This is a 2 on 10 for me, but I also...
So we didn't reach 10.
No, we hit 9, but... But I don't feel like I'm breaking ground by saying I hate this movie. Like, that's just, speaking of birds, I'm not running afoul of any negative, I'm not a hipster by saying I hate Howard the Duck. So it is what it is.
You know, you mentioned something I wanted to talk about, is that we're going to talk when we get to Iron Man. Robert Downey Jr. didn't have the uphill climb that Marvel had to get back on their feet. You're absolutely right. This should have just completely bankrupted everything. But somehow, some way, they crawl their way out of it. And it's going to be interesting to go through all of these movies and see exactly how they do that, because this should have not only bankrupted George Lucas, but bankrupted Marvel as a property.
This is why I think, though, that they were smart for so long. They didn't make their stuff. They licensed it, and their only risk was, did it affect the sales at the newsstand and at your comic shop? It wasn't until Marvel was in their last gasp. Remember, when Iron Man came out, if that didn't work, Marvel as a brand was going to be done completely. So I think it's amazing how times have changed, and we're going to get to see that. This character, think about it. You would think, especially in the last now, what are we at, 16 years of Marvel? Wow. You would think that they'd find a way to bring Howard back in a fun way, and other than two little cameos, we haven't gotten that. Well, technically, he's on also What If, so one What If episode and two little cameos. I know there was a Kevin Smith animated series that was supposed to be done, and that got shit canned, but it's surprising that they haven't done something else with Howard.
Whether they can pull something off like that remains to be seen. Right now, Marvel, to use another joke, they got other ducks they need to get in a row before they can. You know,
they're going back to the well. Is where they got bills to pay.
Yeah, it's called, oh shit, we lost a lot of money and got to win back the press. What's Hugh Jackman doing?
Someone called Downey. Someone called Chris. Someone called the other Chris. How many Chris's can we get into him?
Well, we're going from a movie that almost wrecked Marvel as a brand to a movie that is actually not technically a Marvel movie, but we're still going to review it.
Well, we have to because of its connection with this character, right?
Yeah, so Dr. Mordred, those of you who don't know what I'm even talking about, it's a 1992 movie that was going to be a Doctor Strange movie, but rights expired during pre-production, which is why the character was renamed. But as we'll talk about, there are some things that were carried over, and in a lot of ways, it's sort of, I call it like what Darkman was for Batman 89, where it's like, that movie got made because they couldn't get the rights to Batman, so it's like, fuck it, I'll make my own superhero. This was fully intended to be Doctor Strange's debut, but it didn't happen, and we wouldn't get an official Doctor Strange movie until 2016. But this, we have to review this because it's important to the Marvel history. I take it neither of you have ever seen this.
I have zero recollection of this. There was a 1978 one I remember watching as a kid, the Doctor Strange film that, oof. We talk about sexual imagery in this movie. If we talk about that movie ever, it's got even more. But as far as this movie, no, I had no recollection of this when you put this on the schedule. I've never seen this, so it's going to be a first-time watch for me.
Yeah. Oh boy. I went on Wikipedia. I was like, all right, what's our list of movies? And I was getting excited where we were going next. And then I was like, let me double check our official schedule. And I went, mother. And I sent a message to you guys like, wait, is this real? Is it real? And I found it. And I will say I've watched the trailer. And this is a Doctor Strange film. All they did was take the name off of it. Because this is Doctor Strange.
Because they had to.
Because they were forced. But this thing is written, shot, filmed. Like, it's Doctor Strange. It blows my mind. But this looks like, I don't know, Farscape type sci-fi movie. It's kind of what it looks like. I'm interested. Whatever. We're going to get through it. And, oh, damn you guys.
Well, to take it back to Howard the Duck, I mean, there's no way we're going to get another Howard the Duck, is there? There's no way even James Gunn can come in and say, yeah, I want to do a Howard the Duck.
James Gunn is the one who put in the cameos in Guardians of the Galaxy.
I know. That's why I mentioned it.
And if you go ride Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout, he's there as an Easter egg inside the ride. But yep.
So, the Doctor Strange movie you mentioned in the 70s, it's not a movie, which is why we're not reviewing it. It was supposed to be a pilot for a TV show. Now, the reason why we're not reviewing that, but reviewing the Bill Bixby Hulk movies, is because those were actually, they weren't theatrical release, but they were feature length.
Yep.
Which is, and by that same rule, we are not reviewing the Nick Fury TV movie.
Oh, I thought we were.
Wait, no, that logic, we are reviewing the Nick Fury TV movie.
Oh, okay.
Which I will save for when we get to, like, Captain America, because it's tied into S.H.I.E.L.D. So that's where that will fall. But like I said, there's going to be some TV productions that we do review. Especially because a lot of the Hulk movies have other characters, like Daredevil.
Yep, Thor. Mm-hmm.
So that's why that rule is going to be in place. But we got to our first landmine. but it's the size of the frickin' Hiroshima bomb, basically.
Howard the fucking duck.
We've gotten through that, but we're moving on to a movie that I'd be interested to talk about, because Dr. Mordred's not the same reputation as Howard the Duck, because people don't even know that Dr. Mordred even exists. And if it's any consolation, it's 75 minutes, and it was produced by Full Moon Pictures.
Full Moon. Oh, my God. I didn't know that part.
Yep, so
that's going to be at least one of our ratings.
Oh, fuck. That is like New World as far as Crossbones. Just get me away from it.
No, we're not talking about Crossbones until we get to Winter Soldier. So until next week when we review Dr. Mordred, we got a saying on my planet. If God intended us to podcast, he wouldn't have taken away our wings. Thank you, boys. I'm gonna be risky.
Life is so like a party. I know what you're gonna say.
I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just gonna tell you your fly was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, The Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by, Exy. Words to live by.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Playtime's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Show's over, motherfuckers.
I swear to God, if this is nothing but duck puns, I am getting the fuck off the call.
Oh, says the guy who... Adam, we have to call him out on Catwoman being nothing but puns.
Yeah, I mean, that movie wasn't all it was quacked up to be.
Fuck it.
All right, well, I can cross that...
I hate this so
much.
I
can cross that one off. We're pretty positive we're going to redo X-Men.
Yes.
Because we have to do Generation X, which we did not do for The Old Place, and we have Deadpool and Wolverine to include.
Ugh.
Hey, you wanted this.
I know.
We started shrinking the other day because we got one episode left of Ted Lasso. That's it, just the finale.
Ted Lasso. Never got into that one.
Oh my, it is my happy place. It is, it's my fucking warm
fuzzy.
Wow. It is, now I love Scrubs. I never watched Cougar Town, but it is that feel. Like, like once it's like hits episode 3 and 4, it is one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Mm. Right, let's get into one of the best movies I've ever seen.
And what it does is it makes me think of some of the cues in Tomorrowland, or not Tomorrowland, but in Toontown. Or at least you have to be on the side of Beverly. Beverly? Yeah.
And they say, well, if we do the opposite, then Harold can just... Harold. It doesn't fucking matter. They theorize that Howard can be sent back...
You're right about that, and yeah, Matt, save the Harold talk for when we get to the stand.
Is there a Harold?
Yeah, there's a big character named Harold in that. Plays a big part.
My mind just went to Harry and the Hendersons. That looks better than this.
Certainly a better puppet. So, we're trying to film, and they managed to discover an old, I think I saw this movie with Anna Paquin and Jeff Daniels in the 90s, which also, I'm pretty sure, involved ducks.
What movie was that?
It's called Flying Wild. You've never heard of this movie?
I've never heard of this. Are you sure it wasn't Fly Away Home?
Something like that. It was Jeff Daniels and Anna Paquin when she was like really young.
Oh, man. Yeah, I never saw that.
I'm pretty sure it had to do with ducks.
Oh, shit.
It was like that period where it's like, okay, we're going to make Free Willy with every type of animal. Fly Away Home, that's what it was called.
Okay, I remember the... release. I've never watched it.
A guy who trained geese to follow his aircraft, and it's about how they migration, which is far more interesting than anything in this movie.
Oh my god.
Yeah, this is...
I said beat it!